Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, August 28th. This morning, we hear about calls for a special session to deal with immigration issues. We meet the state's new chief economist, who is big on public service. We stop by a foodland on a Friday and learn how one retiree makes ends meet and fills his shopping cart. We learn about changes on the medical marijuana landscape in Hawaii. And when motherly love is too much, we talk to a new playwright about her show. It's called Smother. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Some state lawmakers are calling for a special session to deal with issues that are developing around immigration. But so far, House and Senate leadership have not said that's likely to happen. Here with the story is government reporter Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning.
So who's leading the charge on this?
Yeah, so there's Representative Della Abilotti, who chairs the Public Safety Committee. You know, she is calling for a special session along with Representative Amy Peruso and others as well. But no word yet from the leadership whether or not that's going to happen. They did set aside a couple of days where they could, and so it's still possible, but this is kind of like what they've been starting to start a conversation about at the Capitol. And, you know, one of the things about immigration that makes it a little bit difficult is that there's no real database or place where information is being centrally collected for in the state about the impacts to the immigration crackdown by President Donald Trump. You know, there's no information necessarily centralized of how many people have been removed or how many people have been detained in all one easy to understand place. But there are organizations that are collecting that information nationwide through Freedom of Information requests to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, like the Deportation Data Project. And so that's how we know that from January through the end of July, there were almost 150 arrests made by ICE agents. And in 2024, there were only 45 in the entire year. So it's been a pretty extreme, dramatic increase here in Hawaii, as well as across the country. And then we also have, you know, anecdotal information from individual instances or people who have told their stories and recounted, you know, what happened to them. I spoke with House Public Safety Committee Chair, you know, Representative Della Abilotti.
We know people are being impacted now. We saw it with the detentions of the Filipino teachers in their homes. Could we have had clearer policies? Certainly. And should we enact those policies now before an escalation of those activities start to occur? Absolutely.
You know, she's referencing an incident in May when over 10 teachers on Maui, several who were here from the Philippines on a visa to fill the teacher shortage here, they were detained in their homes by ICE agents who were looking for a man who lived on the property over a year ago. And so these types of stories are why, you know, Representative Abilotti and other lawmakers and immigration advocates are calling for state policies to put guardrails on immigration enforcement in Hawaii. You know, one would protect places like schools and churches and hospitals from enforcement unless there's a warrant signed by a judge. Here's Hawaii Coalition for Immigrant Rights Director Liza Ryan Gill.
There's no way that any place in the state can keep Immigration and Customs Enforcement out of a location if they have a warrant that is signed by a judge, a judicial warrant. But oftentimes they just have administrative warrants, which are just like self-verified within their own agency that actually do not have the same power as if they were signed by a judge. Now, what we've seen in other states is them working on passing legislation to say, okay, we understand that we can't stop you if you have a warrant that is signed by a judge. But if you don't have a warrant that is signed by a judge, you can't come into this hospital or school.
And, you know, there are other policies that they could look at, like she recommended barring immigration detention centers from being built on state or county lands. Another policy would include limiting local and state law enforcement's relationship with ICE, like making what's called a 287G agreement, where local law enforcement can be signed up to be deputized as ICE agents. They could pass policy that would possibly bar this agreement. You know, in the past, that program has not been really attractive to local law enforcement because it was not not reimbursed by the federal government. But with, you know, that mega bill HR 1, it's making it a lot more attractive to local police departments. And, you know, Ryan Gill says over 780 of those types of agreements have been signed across the country since January. Another policy that's been brought up by several people, you know, would require law enforcement to show their faces and identify themselves. It's in response to incidents across the country where ICE agents have covered their faces and identification. And so it's been difficult for people to tell if they really are federal agents. And it's not clear if state laws would be applied to federal ICE officers. But Representative Abilotti says, you know, it should be codified anyway.
We've only seen in the last 3 months the escalation of what appear to be secret police roaming the streets of America. So we're not going to have the data to say, are these effective or not? But we need these policies in place to then equip both the people who have to enforce these laws and then potentially defend these laws and protect our people.
And, you know, a lot of these policies aren't actually new to the legislature. Some, you know, like the judicial warrant requirement for schools and hospitals or the restriction of detention centers on the state land or county land were actually introduced last session, but didn't pass or didn't gain that much momentum either. So, you know, Ryan Gill hopes that these policies will gain a lot more momentum.
The best would have been that we already had these in place a year ago. The second best is that we do things as quickly as possible. But we also need to be smart and strategic and to make sure that we are watching and understanding what is happening with the community on the ground and the people that are most impacted to make sure that the policy recommendations we have are really addressing the problem that is most endangering community members.
And, you know, she also added that it's necessary for lawmakers to act on these issues quickly as possible. And that's why, you know, Representative Abilotti is urging for the special session to address immigration enforcement. And, you know, she's not the only one. Representative Amy Peruso also echoed her call. You know, one of the things that Representative Peruso said was that during the regular session in January, the legislature is going to have to deal with the massive impacts to the state from that HR 1 mega bill, like the fallout from the Medicaid cutbacks, SNAP, those types of things. And so there's just going to be a lot on their plate when they come back in January. So what Representative Peruso is saying is it would make sense to tackle these immigration issues through a special session in the interim.
I hope, you know, that my colleagues are very much in the same place around this question of immigration and law enforcement and ICE. I think that should be low-hanging fruit. Like, that should be stuff that we can get out of the way during a special session.
And so, like I said before, you know, the Senate and House leadership, they haven't really released any information about a special session. And one of the issues with having one is that there generally needs to be a strong consensus already made among all the members of what needs to get passed. Like, the last big special session was in 2017 to address the rail funding bill. Or you might remember when they reconvened to legalize same-sex marriage in 2013. And so that consensus is needed because, first of all, it's a very short period of time where they've given themselves to a pass this any types of bills during a special session. They've only given themselves 5 days. And they can also only come back if the governor calls them back or there's a two-thirds majority call for it in both chambers. And so that's kind of been the issue where it's not clear if that level of consensus among members is there yet among the immigration issue. But what Representative Bilotti and Representative Peruso and, you know, Liz Ryan Gill are saying is that it's probably time to have a conversation about what these types of bills could look like and maybe build some type of consensus to come back for a special session.
Yeah, because they do have those dates, right, that they were holding.
Exactly. And one of those dates was actually this week, was one of the times they could come back. The next one is at the end of September into the beginning of October. And then there's one more scheduled in the middle of November where they could come back. And originally they set these aside to address the impacts from the HR 1 mega bill in because at the time they weren't sure if that would mean that there'd be huge cuts to Medicaid that were impacted immediately and they would have to reconvene very quickly. But they did set aside these days. And so what some lawmakers are saying is, why don't we use them if we've decided on them already?
Right. But yeah, you can understand if they want to try and collect data, pass the laws now to make it easier to find out information. We had Representative Ed Case on, and he was saying that, you know, they were just told that they were going to be moving immigrants from the mainland over to our detention center at the airport, right? So, yeah, you want to find out who exactly is here and how many because you've got to ramp up
Exactly. Yeah. And there are people who are being held in the federal detention center in Honolulu on immigration.
Yeah. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see what information we can glean. But exactly. Thanks so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from HBR's Ashley Mizuo about calls for a special legislative session around immigration.
September is Classical Music Month, and Hawaii Public Radio is counting down your top 100 compositions. Make sure your favorites are on the list by letting us know your top composers and classical music pieces. Voting ends August 31st. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/classicalmonth.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses designed to engage the mind and enrich lives. Classes begin September 22nd, olliuhm.org.
After 15 years as Hawaii's chief economist, Eugene Tion retired this summer, ending more than three decades in public service. His replacement is Seth Kobe, who didn't start out as an economist, but rather served in the Peace Corps in El Salvador. Kobe has since worked with the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank, and most recently was with the State Tax Office for close to a decade. We spoke with Kobe this morning about his experience and vision for the role.
One of the things that I personally believe is I think public sector service is sacred, meaning that you really need good government employees in order to have a functioning private sector and to allow other people to do things, right? Because you want clear ideas, you want the government to execute things well and in a way that people understand. And one of the things that I really enjoy is I love playing that role, right? And so I originally took the job at the Department of Taxation because people usually go and sleep the minute they think about taxes. But as an economist, I was like, wait a minute, tax policy affects every single citizen of Hawaii and nobody wants to touch it. So to me, it was an underappreciated role. And I do think that tax policy was really important. And I was able to witness some pretty big changes with the state tax policy. The state enacted the largest tax cut in its history in 2024. And just working with our legislators and our decision makers to help them think through what they want to accomplish using economic reasoning. So economics is very good to weigh in on trade-offs. You can do this or you can do this, right? But there's no such thing as a free lunch in economics, right? And so oftentimes decision makers say, oh, I really want to do this. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. However, have you thought about this implication and this implication? So oftentimes there are second or third level consequences of your decisions. And that's what I love about economics is it helps people think that way.
Right. So rather than have people's eyes glaze over when you talk about economics, you say, hey, you're making decisions every day when you go to the supermarket or go to the store and are deciding what purchases are you going to commit to.
Exactly. Economists love to think about incentives and what kind of incentives we're creating for people. And oftentimes, like a good law can be designed with really well intentions, but it creates different incentives that are sometimes counterproductive to what they really want to go. So a really traditional one like this is rent control, right? Everybody's really upset that prices are going up. And what we just have to do is create a law that prices don't go up anymore in rents. But what does that do to incentives? One, there's no incentive to build any more housing, right? Because a developer won't get their money back. People who already do own housing and rent it out don't have the incentive to upgrade the apartments, right? Because if, you know, they need shelving or new plumbing, they can't get the extra money back by raising rents. One of the biggest things in economic consensus across the political spectrum is that rent control doesn't work. In fact, it makes rents higher over the long term. So that's a great example of like how secondary effects are often different from the original intention of the bill.
And then you have an interesting background. You were in the Peace Corps.
Right.
What did that experience teach you, and what do you bring to the table?
Yeah, so I was actually a biology major in undergrad. And so I went down into the Peace Corps in El Salvador to really work with people, help them improve their lives, and hopefully help them improve the environment as well. When I went down there, I was young, recent college grad, and I just thought, hey, if we could all just work together, we could make everything better, right? So we could build a well if I could just get the community to come on time. And what I found was they'll show up once or twice, but at the end of the day, they needed a job and they needed money. And so that was a big wake-up call for me. And I was working with all these people who worked, in many cases, harder than the people I grew up with, were just as smart, just as capable, yet they were much poorer than the people I grew up with. And so one of the things I wanted to understand is, why are some people wealthier, societies wealthier than others? And so I went to grad school to answer that question. I got a master's, I got a PhD in economics, and in many ways, I'm still answering that question, but I have a much better understanding of why there is inequality and what are the driving forces of that.
Yeah, we are in such interesting times. The administration is cracking down on immigration, and there are many that point out, gosh, if we didn't have these immigrant workers, our hotels wouldn't run, vegetables and fruits wouldn't get picked, just those ramifications. And yeah, like you said, you make a decision and then there's a consequence.
Yep. So right now, for example, in Hawaii, one of the things, about, if you talk to any business owner or a lot of business owners, they're struggling for workers, right? And for the entry level jobs, around minimum wage, laborers, a lot of those are filled by immigrants. And by either restricting them or even reducing the immigrant workforce, we're restricting the amount of labor that is available to our small businesses. So this is going to be a challenge coming forward. In Hawaii, we have the lowest unemployment rate in the country, and more than a strong economy, that represents a lack of workers. And so it is going to affect us here in Hawaii as well.
And we have a aging workforce. Mm-hmm. When you look at the age of our farmers and just the demographics, the data book just came out, and that I just love that book because you have all these interesting factoids. And I know when my son was born, it was like, wow, okay, this was a spike here. And I know that spike is going to follow him when he competes to get into schools and colleges. Yep. And jobs. And yet you see now, you know, a drop. There aren't as many wait lists now. And so mm-hmm. It's just fascinating.
Right. And we have one of the lowest labor participation rates in the country. Even though it costs so much to live here, a larger percentage of our population decides not to work or is not working relative to, I think we're like the sixth lowest in the whole entire country. That reflects our aging workforce. It reflects that the people who are entering the workforce don't feel that they're getting as much value for their time as they would normally like. And it's a huge problem because Hawaii businesses are faced with this really unique challenge of they have to pay some of the highest wages in the country, but their workers feel like they're the lowest paid. So you're not getting the highest quality workers if they don't feel like they're getting the biggest value. And so that's just a big challenge facing businesses here and something that we really need to think about, because talking about the long-term challenges facing Hawaii, we used to have the state's income used to be above the national average. And it was pretty consistently like that until about 1990. You look at a graph, we start declining. Around in the mid-2000s, we went below the national average, and now we're there. And so we're on a slow, steady state of stagnation relative to the rest of the country. And that is something that has huge implications for Hawaii. So I used to work at the Department of Taxation. And one of the things I looked on was like revenue sufficiency, right? Are we bringing enough tax revenues to cover what we need? And it doesn't sound like this much, but over a 30-year time horizon, the difference between 4.5% growth and 2.5% growth in revenue growth is a pension crisis because of the compounding nature of what we're doing. So 1% over 1 year doesn't matter very much. Over 30 years, you're talking about double the amount of revenue. And so when we have declining growth rates, over time, it may not feel like a big deal from year to year, but we're not going to be able to pay our teachers. We're not going to be able to invest in our vulnerable populations. And so this is something that we have, as a society, have to decide how we want to deal with that. Because right now, if we don't have higher levels of economic growth, we're creating a situation where nobody's going to like the results.
And we've heard economists sound this alarm. Mm-hmm. You need to wake up. We need to do something yesterday. Like, you don't realize the path we're going on. And it's a downward spiral if we continue on.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people feel it day to day. It's just human beings are great at adapting to circumstances. So yesterday, even if it like kind of bothers us, we can deal with today. So our children are leaving, right, the state of Hawaii for other opportunities, especially the qualified young people between 20 and 30. They tend to leave Hawaii, which is a sign. Housing affordability is not there. People are just grumpy sometimes with all the frustration, right? And so that's a sign that as a society, we're not delivering the basic things, right? One of the ironies of this whole situation is like in the 1970s, Hawaii and the whole entire world was much poorer than we are now. Or probably 1960s is a better example, right? Recent statehood. But people were optimistic. Even though there was like 9 people living in a house, plantation style house, they were excited about the future. Nowadays, people are pretty grumpy. Very few people live in 9 to a house, but they're not very excited about the future. And so that's a kind of an implicit feeling that everybody has that, yeah, there is something wrong and we're going in the wrong, in a direction that nobody likes.
So you want to be able to put that vision in focus to start off.
Exactly. So our job is not to tell people what to do, but to paint scenarios and to say, these are the trade-offs that are there. It's up to our state leaders and our whole entire Hawaii about the direction that we want to go. One of the advantages of being a small island community is we can actually get all the people together to talk and decide the direction that they want to go. That's much easier to do here than in a place like Arizona, where 6 million people, you don't really know who, what. Here, it's not impossible to understand who are the major players here, what the different people want in a way forward. And so as an economist, I view our job as a supporting role in that and saying, hey, these are the facts. You guys make the decisions.
As we leave off here, share with our listeners maybe one thing that amazes you about that data book.
One of the amazing things about that data book is there's information about everything. So I was just browsing in it right before this interview, and I learned that we've added 60 new bridges in Hawaii over the last 20 years. And I didn't think we built anything, any new infrastructure in Hawaii. So that was interesting. But you can also learn about workforce development and where people are taking jobs and how many people are leaving the state. And so what I really suggest people to go do is just go to the data book page and click on a table. There's ones about the economy. There's ones about national defense. There's ones about food and agriculture. And just look through the thing. And you will see some trends that are really interesting. They're pretty easy tables to understand. And you can start to get a visceral or actually a pretty explicit feeling about the direction of where Hawaii is going. Because in a lot of cases, the data goes all the way back to the 1960s, 1970s. And it's fascinating to see how we've changed.
Yeah, it's tracking trends.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Seth Colby, thank you so much for coming down here today.
Pleasure.
That was Seth Colby, who is assuming the role of Hawaii's chief economist after Eugene Tion retired this summer. Time now for another installment of What's in Your Cart. We visit grocery stores around the islands and ask you how changes in the economy are affecting your shopping habits. Ever visited a foodland on a Friday? Well, you might have noticed that it's a bit more crowded because the hot food bar has steep discounts. This is no surprise to John, a retiree who lives in Honolulu and takes advantage of the discounts nearly every week. He talked to The Conversation's D.W. Gibson about his approach to making his food budget work.
I got stuff on sale. I got the hot and cold buffet. I got the 3 salsa for $6, 2 strawberries for $6.
This sounds like very targeted shopping.
It was totally targeted.
Now, do you come here for the hot food on Fridays often?
Almost every week, because it's a good price.
And are you always getting the same thing, or you mix it up?
I have to mix it up because they don't have the same thing every week. Plus, the side things are different every week.
So do you discover when you come here what's on sale, or is it sort of something that you look up in advance?
Yeah, no, they send me a notice in advance. So you have to put up with the crazy crowd, but it's worth it.
How does this fit into your bigger shopping picture? Because it sounds like you're someone who appreciates a good bargain.
I do. I probably buy more because it's a good price than I ordinarily would. So I pay a price for that. I know I'm putting on some weight, so.
How are you feeling about the economy in general these days?
You know, I watch it. I think so far it's okay. I'm not a tariff fan at all, but so far when you buy the bargains, it's not so bad.
Are you still in the working world? Are you retired these days?
No, I'm retired.
Yeah. What did you do?
I was in the military. So my worst case is I can go to the base and shop at the commissary. But you know what? They've gone up in prices. So I'm not wild about going there, but I will if I have to.
So you go there on occasion, but you've noticed at the commissary that the prices have gone up significantly.
Absolutely. Yes.
That was John from Honolulu talking to HPR's D.W. Gibson outside of a foodland. How's the economy affected your spending habits? Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Manoa Valley Theater's Demea, Lee Cataluna's island-style comedy about a fictional new mayor who wants to keep his past a secret, opens September 11th. ManoaValleyTheater.com.
I'm Anita Rao. Dyslexia affects up to 20% of the U.S. population, and intervention is about more than just reading.
We want to help students understand that they are capable of doing great things, not just in the class, but outside the class, and that starts with the mind.
Why dyslexia is a science and social justice issue. Join us next time on Embodied.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
A New York Times piece this month highlighted a growing problem with cannabis gummies around the country. It looked at data from the nation's poison centers and found a sharp increase in cases. Interviews with doctors pointed to an alarming trend. Dozens of children across the country had gotten into stashes belonging to relatives and were hospitalized for symptoms of cannabis poisoning. Many pointed to weed gummies and other edibles as the culprits. We sat down with Andrew Goff, a program manager with the State Health Department. He recently took over the Office of Medical Cannabis Control and Regulation. We talked with him about how physicians can stay ahead of emerging trends with continuing medical education and how to keep our keiki and kapuna safe.
So that is a very serious concern nationally and here too. We have run the numbers, and our Poison Control Center data shows that we have a very small amount of pediatric issues here, but it still is a big concern. So, you know, one of the focuses of the program is to make sure that the products in a medical cannabis dispensary are not appealable to children, to make sure that the packaging is plain and childproof. And we encourage everyone that is using medical cannabis to, you know, use it like a prescription drug. You wouldn't keep that in a jar on your counter, so store it in the same place as you would any medication.
Right, so you just want to make sure that our keiki are not, you know, getting into trouble, getting into some of this.
Absolutely, and it is a big concern, especially, you know, there's a lot of products out there that are sold on the shelves that look like candy, that have the same shape and the same, you know, cartoons, and actually look like candy you'd be familiar with, like gummy bears. And we want to make sure that the stuff that's out there is compliant with the cannabis laws and with the hemp laws, and that is not, you know, it's not allowed in Hawaii right now.
And then the Department of Health is also concerned about the effect of some of the medical cannabis that is out there and how it affects our seniors, because a lot of our seniors are on maybe medications. So what's the word that you're trying to get out?
Yeah, so seniors, that's one of the fastest growing demographics we see in new patient registrations. And there's a lot of information out there on how it could be helpful for seniors and how it can reduce pains. You know, arthritis is one of the qualifying conditions. There's a couple others that would be relevant to seniors. So I think just the information out there, if you're considering medical cannabis and you are a senior, always make sure to talk it over with your healthcare provider. Your provider will know how to use it and how to incorporate it into your treatment plan. Cannabis, even if you're using it kind of therapeutically, or even if you're using just CBD gummies to go to sleep, you know, cannabinoids can interact with any medications that you are currently on. So you want to make sure you talk to your provider and see if your medications are safe to take with cannabis, and to just have a discussion on how to use it.
Okay, give us an example.
A lot of the products do have a lot of CBD in them. It can be effective at lower doses, but it can interact with common medications, blood thinners, seizure medications, things like that. And especially, you know, as you get older, if you are on a regimen of different medications, it's important to inform the doctor that you are taking this also as a supplement, so that if it does interact, the doctor should know. And then kind of along those lines too, to help providers be up to date and informed on this, the Department of Health has created a CME course. We're offering it for free for the first 200 providers to sign up, and it covers the endocannabinoid system and how you can use cannabinoids therapeutically, and then also things like drug interactions, so that providers are able to have this conversation with patients.
Well, I mean, you know, we often hear how blood thinners maybe don't mix with, I think it's grapefruit juice, right?
That's right. It's very similar to that.
So all those impacts that people may not realize, you know, are out there.
I think we have about 100 providers signed up. So the first 200 are free. So there's still some spots available. And then after the first 200, they're going to be still available for a fee.
And these classes, are they here in Honolulu? Are they available via Zoom for, you know, neighbor island folks?
Yeah, they're all online. And they do cover the Hawaii-specific conditions that we allow for. And there is a module on there that addresses the Hawaii regulations. So if you are interested in being a provider and certifying patients to use medical cannabis, it explains how you do that.
And then are there any changes to the law or to the program that are on the near future on the landscape that you can talk about?
Yeah. So this past legislative session, there were several changes that expands access to patients. And one of them is allowing telehealth for visits. So but previously, you were allowed to have telehealth for recurring visits, but your initial visit had to be established through in an in-person meeting. And now, to reach better people that maybe can't get out of their house, or people that are in more rural areas that don't have access to providers, you can do the whole thing through telehealth. And we'll be issuing some guidance shortly on to providers again on how to take advantage of this and how to do it correctly, because there still are some parameters around it. But we are hopeful that that will allow patients who previously couldn't have access to talk to a provider who's familiar with cannabis and can actually certify them. Also, one of the important changes is it allows for hospice care. So cannabis can be really effective in easing end-of-life transitions, and it allows for hospice providers, if they choose, to certify patients to use cannabis in that instance.
Wow. So really, there's a lot that it's moving in the cannabis landscape.
Oh, yeah. It's expanding on the medical side and then on the hemp side, too. So we have a lot of changes coming up. I'm new to the program, so one of the things that I want to see is a lot more education and outreach to patients and providers and caregivers also on how to interface with our office and how to better use cannabis therapeutically.
And then on the hemp issue, so explain to our listeners, you know, why there may be some, you know, concern about some products that might be on the market. Let's say for the gummies, like hemp gummies, you know, you would think, well, wouldn't you just get that through, you know, a certified, you know, lab where it's allowed?
Yeah, so hemp is an interesting challenge because the products have cannabinoids in them. So even if you take a CBD gummy, it could have other cannabinoids in there like THC. Our laws currently require certain labeling and certain packaging, but the fact is there's a lot of stuff sold in stores, sold online, that is not really compliant with our laws. So one of the changes that came this year was a hemp retailer registration. So starting next year, we're going to have a retail registration. So if anybody wants to sell hemp, they have to register with us. And then we can inspect them and make sure they're selling it compliant to what our state laws are. We have very high standards with testing and with labeling to make sure if you buy something, you know what you're getting. And so our hope is we'll have a list of registered retailers. And if somebody wants a CBD gummy, they know where to go and get one that is compliant.
Yeah. And explain then, you know, about the dosing, right? Because we want to make sure that what you're buying is what it says on the label.
Absolutely. So, you know, first, I'm not a doctor, so I can't really give advice on dosing. But as far as what's the testing and everything, the hemp testing is really important to know what kind of cannabinoids are in your product. And a lot of the cannabinoids have been chemically converted from other cannabinoids and kind of changed into new cannabinoids that maybe we don't know exactly the safety profile on them or how they interact with the body, especially in concentrated doses or long-term use. And so the focus is more to at least know what's in the product and to ensure that if there is an intoxicating cannabinoid or one of these chemically converted cannabinoids, you know, either the concentration is low or with the converted cannabinoids, you just aren't allowed to put them in the product.
I wonder, too, about the dosing, just because I know we had someone in our family was on Ambien and she was tiny. And she wasn't sleeping well and then ended up, you know, breaking a tablet in half, not knowing this was a time release thing.
Right.
And then she was getting like a mega dose. And, you know, we only found out because we were talking to her on the phone and she was slurring her, you know, her words. And we were just saying something's not right. And that's how it got diagnosed, is because she was getting this mega dose, not knowing that it was a time release and that shouldn't have happened.
That's interesting. Yeah. So especially for gummies, you know, everyone's body reacts differently to cannabis and cannabinoids, and the dosage of the gummies and how fast they release is different from product to product. So our advice always is start low, go slow. If you're unsure of the product and not familiar with it, start with a little piece with a small dose and wait up to 2 hours, because the way gummies work is they are absorbed through the liver, which can make the delivery a lot more potent than if you just used it through smoking or through vaping. And it takes a little bit longer to release. So you don't want to be in a situation where you take one, you're not feeling anything, you know, 20 minutes later, you take another one, still not feeling anything, take another one. And then in 3 hours, you know.
It hits you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you don't want to be driving.
Exactly. Exactly. So you want to make sure that you have some time and space to explore it and to really start low and go slow.
Okay. This is all really good information. And then is there anywhere that our listeners can go if they need to get information, or anywhere where the physicians can go to get information about the classes?
Yeah. Our website has a lot of information. Our website has links to the classes if you need it. We also have a press release out that has links to the classes. And our website has a lot of information for patients. And if you're a patient and you are considering it, I would say talk to your provider about it. If you want to find a provider that specializes in cannabinoid medicine, we do have a list on our website of providers that provide that. And just call us and ask, and we'll talk to you about it.
All right. Well, Andrew Goff, thank you so much for coming down here and talking
with
us.
Thank you so much.
That was Andrew Goff, head of the State Health Department's Office of Medical Cannabis Control and Regulation. Kukuhua Theater's fall season kicks off with productions that feature strong female characters. The first in the series opens tonight and spotlights the bonds of maternal love. The play is called Smother. It's about a mother who tries to control her daughter's love life. Playwright Sarah Ward is no stranger to theater. She's Kumukuhua's box office and house manager. She spoke with The Conversation's Lillian Song about the process of writing the new play, her first.
First of all, I want to say it's quite funny. We have an actress in the lead role who's really good at comedy. And then it also has very poignant, heartfelt moments, which give us all a chance to reset from that hilarity and take a moment to think about some things. There are parts of my real relationship with my two daughters. And there's some parts that are completely fictionalized. There's a lot of moments that mothers will definitely understand and relate to. But there's some guy humor in there, thanks to the director, Harry Wong III. He's got some classic moments in there of guy humor. And just the story, even if you're not a mother, but you're a family of somebody, I think you can relate to that dynamic of how people get along and how they try their best when they love somebody to help them through, even if the way I'm helping them maybe isn't going about it the right way, but it comes from a place of love.
Hmm. You've raised them since they were babies. The character of Marsha, the mother character, based on you, and Julia would be that hybrid of your two daughters. Julia is 23, young adult, getting ready to flex those wings. You, as that mother who's gone through different experiences, you want to impart your wisdom. You don't want her to get hurt.
Yeah, that's such a hard time, really, because you had this child who did whatever you said for 10, 11 years and then sort of started, you know, oh, mom, you're not cool. I want to wear what I want to wear. But you work that out because you're still in charge. And then they go away to college and they come back for that first college break around 19 years old, and all of a sudden they know everything and you are the dumbest person in the world. And yet they're still completely reliant on you because you're still paying their college fees and they're coming home to sleep and eat your food and you're sending them money. But they want total independence, but you are like, well, I'm paying, so you should still do what I want to do. So you kind of have to work out that. And then if you see them making what you think is a mistake, whether it's in their career choice or their relationship choice, you go into like this panic, you know, like, well, she's doing the wrong thing and she's going to hate her career or she won't make enough money to pay some rent. And what I think of, and what Marsha, this is a big part of the play, is, what if I die and she cannot function? So my whole goal has been to get my children to a place where if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, I know they're going to have a roof over their head, food in their mouth, and hopefully a family structure, whether it be a chosen family or maybe one of my daughters did get married, so she has now her husband and his family. But my other daughter, who isn't married, has a very supportive chosen family that she can turn to in the case. So I feel very good now. I feel very confident now in both of them to survive out there in the big, bad world. Mm. And that was my goal, really.
This is what audiences will see on stage, this story about growing up, finding boundaries, the dynamic of mother, daughters, realigning those boundaries. But the backstory, it's pretty neat too. How did this play come about? Because you have been a part of the theater community. You design props. You're the house manager, box office manager. What helped you find your way to becoming a playwright?
Well, so I've always secretly wanted to be a writer. I mean, on my OneDrive, I have 25 books, poems, plays that are like half finished. You come to a point, and I feel like I'm a little bit advantaged because I've sat in on hundreds of rehearsals and watched plays over and over again as I worked at Manoa Valley Theater and at Kumu. So I kind of have a little bit of like a knowledge of what people are looking for in a play and what will sell, which can also be a disadvantage because then I don't have as much freedom to just create the most crazy thing in the world. But there comes a point if you don't have that structure, if you don't have the knowledge of where to go from here, where your play, even though your idea is great, but you don't really know how to finish it or how to get from scene one to scene two or how to, you know, just put in those little engaging moments that maybe you know what you want to say, but you just don't quite know how the mechanics of it work. And so at Kumu Kahua, we have the opportunity for people to take free playwriting classes. We have other classes too, but the ones I'm particularly interested in are the playwriting classes. And the teachers in those classes, they really understand. So one of our teachers, Victoria Newbull and Lee Tonouchi, the Pigeon Gorilla, is the teacher that I was taking the class from at this time. They really understand how that process works because they both have been so successful in their long careers. And so if you take your idea into that class, they can show you the next step and teach you the play structure and how to make a great beginning and how to make a great ending. And sometimes that's all you need because you had that idea already. If you don't have an idea and you just come to it as a love for theater, a love for writing, a love for wanting to make plays, then a great way to start is with our one-day playwriting workshops about 4 or 5 times a year, taught by Harry Wong III and Daniel A. Kellen II from HTY. And the great thing about Kumu is, and I'm really proud of this, we've been offering these classes for the last 4 years for free to the community. Mm-hmm. One-day workshops, as of now, are in person. The classes with Lee Tonouchi and Victoria Newbull for the last 3 years have been on Zoom.
What is the commitment for these longer classes that are free being offered by Kumu Kahua? What's my obligation?
Well, the great thing about the one-day workshop is you just got to commit 1 day, and we even provide you with lunch. The classes on Zoom with Victoria and Lee were a Saturday or a Sunday morning for 3 hours for 6 weeks. Mm. And we do ask that to the best of your ability, you do try to attend all 6 classes. Because if you can't attend all 6 classes, you're definitely going to be the one who's missing out.
And for yourself, Sarah, Smother came out of this playwriting class. You also acknowledge that you have a drive full of ideas, have written scripts, whatnot. How long was that time frame to go from going to the classes, identifying, and now having an actual play being put on?
It's been 2 years because I was in that class June and July of 2023. And now here it's August 2025. So it was 2 years, 2 very proud, interesting, and illuminating years. And now to see it on the stage is both terrifying and happy.
I'm sure. And now you get to be that person putting your work on stage. What is it that you hope your audience will leave with after seeing Smother?
I hope they reflect on their relationships, and maybe it made them feel a little better about their relationships because they're not as crazy as Marcia. I hope that they can laugh a little. Well, actually, I hope they can laugh a lot and maybe cry a little bit at a couple of the more poignant moments. But I want them in the end to leave feeling uplifted.
Well, is there anything that we haven't covered that you would like to have our listeners know about?
Well, if they're not really inspired by playwriting, but they'd like to take other classes, we do have other classes as well. And we do try at this time, and it's been this way for 4 years, to keep our classes free to the community. Mm-hmm. So if they're interested in any of these things, please give me a call at the theater. Our number is on the website, or sign up for our email list, because we do not inundate your mailbox at all. We only send out a few emails, but the emails we do send out are very informative. Oh, we also have a playwriting contest every month, and you can win $100. And so we send out our emails about those things, what the contest will be this month, what play we're going to be doing, and what our classes will be.
The classes, if they're not about playwriting, are they acting classes?
Yeah. So just recently, our last class that we had in June, while the playwriting class was going on Zoom, we had a class in the theater. It's improv, led by a great improv practitioner, Michael Donato. He did that class all through June and then a performance in July for his students, which everyone loved. They did a great job. So that was our most recent class. We also have a directing class that goes on every year, and it's actually about 6 months. So we usually only do it once a year. 5 or 6 sessions in person with Harry Wong, the artistic director of our theater, who directs many of our plays. So he has lots of experience. He'll do 5 or 6 sessions in person, and then they watch plays around the community. He finds out which play would be most in line with the class for that semester, and then they would go out, watch the play, and then get back together again to discuss. So it all in all takes about 6 months for that class.
You're going to be given access to all these professionals, and if this is something that you're interested in, why not take advantage of the opportunity? And at this point, still free?
Still free.
How is that possible? Today's day and age. You have some really good supporters behind Kumu Kuhua.
Yeah, and that's what's important to us. And at Kumu, our priorities are that everyone should have access to theater and to classes. So despite the economic realities, especially nowadays in this current climate, it's our priority. So there's opportunities, too, for people to have ticketed discounts. And we even have a program, our founder, Dennis Carroll, there's a program in his honor that people, if they are unable to afford tickets, they can give us a call. And we do have a amount of tickets that we are able to give away for each show for free as a part of our mission. Wow. Thanks to the legacy of Dennis Carroll, who strongly believed that because of economics, you should not be barred from the experience of theater. So please come and enjoy Smother from August 28th to September 28th. We'd love to see you there.
Well, that was playwright Sarah Ward and HPR's Lillian Song. Ward is well recognized as a props designer who also works the front of the theater as Kumu Kuhua's box office and house manager. Her first play, Smother, debuts tonight at 7 p.m. And fun fact, you'll be able to catch former HPR Weekend anchor Jackie Young in the cast. We should note, Kumu Kuhua Theater is an underwriter of HPR.
Promise not to judge.
Well, that is it for us today. Up tomorrow, we have a Hana Ho show planned for you, highlighting recent conversations we've had with local authors. The clock is ticking to finish your summer reads. Got feedback for us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.